Hello and welcome to the Scottish Rock Podcast, the official podcast of the Scottish Rock Garden Club. I'm your host Connor. As always, be sure to check out the Scottish Rock website at www.srgce.net for the most recent information on shows, lectures, the Scottish Rock Journal and the International Rock Gardener. So, hi.
Hi.
And you feel all right with everything?
You mean the pandemic?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not always a guy that's that much in touch with his feelings, but you know, at first there wasn't much of a change in my life. Like, I worked at home quite a bit. Right, you know, March 12th, 13th, I think we got the memo to go home and stay home. And I don't have an office anymore. For the first little while, it was fine. I had a huge project. I was spending a lot of time online, speaking on, you know, Microsoft Teams and whatnot, video sort of chat. And work was fine, and my life hadn't changed that much. But what I really, I went into screen overload. And all, you know, plant club meetings, things like that. I actually skipped the Alpine Garden Club of BC's meeting in May, which was done on Zoom, because I couldn't take any more screen time. And that's pretty bad because I'm vice president of that club. So, yeah, that and the NARGS event that took place in June, I think I just was burned out on the screen time. But at the same time, I started to really miss the folks that are in the clubs. And, you know, Jenny Wainwright Klein was coming to speak in Vancouver. And of course, that was canceled. And so it's been a little bit different for me. And it's been a tough time, but I did get a lot done in the garden and in that time as well. So
meetings over Zoom and these online courses or chatting to people and lectures and stuff like that, I think they're great, but they're never going to replace the real thing. They're always close, but it just felt a little short.
Yeah, it was a shock. That's exactly it. You know, for me at work, it wasn't that much different, but, you know, I'd had Mike Bone here, I think, the week before, you know, things got really serious, and he spoke in Vancouver, and I had him for the day. We had a great time, and he spoke. It was a great talk. And then the next day, I think he was flying to Calgary, and he did like one more talk on his tour. And then the rest of the tour was scrapped. And, you know, things like that, that really hit home that, geez, this is for real. The borders are going to close. And wild time.
Yeah. Have you got a similar heat wave to what's going on in the rest of the world as well, where you are?
No, it's the opposite. You know, I bought a house with a swimming pool 2 years ago. So, of course, we've had two of the crappiest summers I can remember in the last 2 years. So, yeah, no, it's been kind of a mixed bag here. A lot of cool weather, summertime showers, which is, you know, quite rare in Western BC, Southwestern BC in July and August. It's a very dry place typically. And we've had quite a bit of gray weather. So, no, I don't have the heat wave that everybody else does. I wish they'd send it here.
Yeah, I think that's because I visited Vancouver, I think it was 3 years ago now, Vancouver and Victoria. And I think a lot of people, including myself at that time, I saw Canada as being, you know, this kind of snow-covered country with lots of conifer forest, and it rained a lot. And yeah, Vancouver and Victoria were very different. They were a lot drier than I anticipated.
Yeah, it depends on the time of year, I guess, and maybe a little bit the luck of the draw. But in Vancouver, you know, geez, nine months of the year, it drizzles a lot. Victoria, they get a break because of the Olympic rain shadow, and it's a little bit warmer there. and they can get away with quite a bit more than we can in Vancouver. But yeah, a lot of people don't realize. I mean, we get a kind of a reputation for being soaking wet 12 months of the year, and Seattle gets lumped into that too. But really, it's a very, usually a very dry summer here, owing to, the Pacific high that develops in the Gulf of Alaska. It just deflects everything, and we usually have 2 months of pure sunshine, but kind of got a little bit of a raw deal this year and last.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've in Scotland here, we've hit like new record highs. I think last year it hit 33 degrees, which is the warmest ever recorded in Scotland. And then this year it's 26 degrees outside right now, which, I've like grown up, I remember we would get warm days every once in a while, or we'd hit like 25. Like 1 week of the year, and everyone would lose their minds. But now it seems to be, yeah, a lot more regular that we'll hit a really kind of warm spell. It's normally we'll have a lot of rain early July, and then it suddenly gets really warm, which, yeah, it makes it quite difficult to try and pick stuff to grow when your climate should be doing something and it's doing something completely different.
Well, yeah, I guess it kind of blends into a longer conversation, but things are changing, and yeah, I guess we're all kind of being forced to adapt to these changing conditions, and probably not too many people feel it more than gardeners.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So, for your kind of plants that you're focusing on, there are lots of, arguably a bit more dry land species as well. So, kind of xerophytic plants, from places like Chile or the Rockies or Pacific Northwest. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm all over the map, as you know. So there's quite a dip. There's a hodgepodge of plants and sort of little areas here in the yard in Vancouver. But the main challenge in Vancouver is winter rain, and I do like a challenge. So there are quite a few xeric plants or dry land plants in my rock garden, particularly my scree garden, and in a few other beds where I've taken advantage of microclimates. And yeah, in those beds I do like to focus on a lot of Great Basin species, a lot of southwestern species, South Africans. I don't have a whole lot of South Americans, but I'd like to go there for sure. I'm gonna have to build more garden for that, I think. But yeah, I do have an interest in dry land plants, and especially those from, especially the Great Basin and Southwest.
Yeah, you spoke about Mike Bone earlier as well. He came to the Botanics, and me and Elizabeth, who runs the Alpine department at the Botanics in Edinburgh, were walking around with him. And yeah, some of the plants and some of the photos that he was showing us was just incredible. Deilosperma was one of the plants that they have all over, and we had a couple very poor looking plants in comparison to what they can get away with.
I've had the pleasure of working in Denver quite a bit, just through my company's got one of their main offices there, so I get into the botanical garden quite a bit in Denver, and take a lot of inspiration from what Mike and Mike Kinchin are doing in the steppe and rock gardens. So yeah, for sure, it's very inspirational what they do that down there in Denver, and it's fun to try and mimic that in a place where it does rain 8 or 9 months of the year.
Yeah, no, so as for inspiration as well, so that's a source of inspiration. You mentioned when we were chatting last night that Peter Korn came over to do a lecture for the kind of local group, and you said he made a big impact with his kind of philosophy on growing plants.
He did, yeah. And he kind of reinforced some earlier exposure to ideas about gardening that were new to me, that were brought about by David Sellers here locally. David had he'd spoken to me personally about what he does with a local sand product, and he'd written a couple articles about it. And you know, at first I thought, you know, geez, David is an amazing guy. He's able to grow all kinds of things. Just a great plantsman. And I wasn't ready to take the plunge with the pure sand that he was talking about. But Peter Korn came maybe 4 years ago now and showed what he'd done in Sweden with his property there. And at first, you know, everybody's jaw dropped at the idea that he'd moved all that rock with like a pry bar and a wheelbarrow. But apart from being nuts that way, he used a lot of sand. And geez, you know, I saw things like cacti in the pictures and dry land yuccas and things like that. And these are plants that I do have a keen interest in. And hearing it from Peter that you can do amazing things with coarse sand, it kind of made me warm up to what David had been saying all along as well. That there's, you know, there's a local quarry product called seashell sand, which is it sounds like seashells, but there's actually a town called Seashell. And the other impression people get is, oh, this must be beach sand from seashell, but it's not. It's a crusher product that has a lot of angular sort of pebbles in it, from maybe a half centimeter, 3/4 of a centimeter down to like the fines, down to the dust. And David had always told me that his thinking growing alpines in seashell sand was that the plants were from above the tree line in many cases, and they were adapted to screes and basically a soilless medium. And the troubles we had, you know, in addition to poor drainage of the local native soil, is that the plants were susceptible to pathogens here at sea level as well. So he was more focused on alpines, and Peter was more, you know, he was focused on a whole wide range of plants in sand. And I got to discuss that with Peter a little bit after his talk, and I follow him on social media, so I get advice here and there. You know, if I ask him a quick question about what he's doing or evolution in his thought or whatever, I get that from him. I should actually pay respect to Kent and Seth. Kent actually told me in 2014, I think, about a product in Colorado that they use, and I think it's called Breeze locally, which is very very similar to the seashell sand product that's available here. And he was telling me then that was a kind of a new frontier in Colorado, is growing in that product down there. So yeah, there's been some influences. And finally, when I bought my new house 2 years ago, I decided to do a large scale bed and take the plunge. I purchased tons of rock, and I had several tons of this seashell sand delivered here at the house. And I went outside in January. It was a very mild January, and after work with halogen lights, I built the garden. And so I've had 2 years here, in addition to a small test bed that I did at my house, the house that we were in before this one. I had about 2 years there with a very small sand bed because I wasn't really quite ready to take the plunge into sand gardening
Yeah.
then, but lots of success. All of the things that David said you could grow locally in that sand, all of it's come true. He was exactly right, and lots of things that I have tried for myself that I didn't think would work, and I only try them because Peter Korn kind of blazed the trail, and I've seen him do amazing things. So yeah, I love the sand.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think I first got told about it, a couple years ago as well, and they were like, "Oh, you can just grow stuff in, you know, if you get a good type of sand, you can just grow it in that." And I was like, "Well, what do you mean? How? What do you mean it will just grow perfectly?" And then they told me about it was Peter Korn I heard about, and even in the Alpine house, you can see certain plants that are in like a sand plunge bed, and they've seeded out, and it's pure sand, and they were perfectly happy. And then you'll lift them and pot them up. Lots of Saxifraga cuttings are taken, and pretty much pure sand as well. So it did get me thinking that, although I was a bit skeptical to start with, you know, the results are there and it was working. So how could it not work with more plants, or maybe particular plants that we've been struggling with for a while? Maybe that's the kind of key to unlock some of the genera, some of the species that we've been struggling with.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as you know, here in Vancouver, I have, geez, I have Lewisiopsis tweedii, in that sand. I have several acantholymon species in that sand. I mean, these are plants that are not easily or commonly grown in Vancouver, for sure. I have cacti out there. I have agaves. Lots of things that you know, people walking by on the street, they stop and look, and that's pretty impressive. I mean, you just gotta have faith in the sand and make sure you have the right product. I get asked a lot, you know, well, I don't know what that is. Can I just use beach sand or play sand? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, you've got to get the right stuff, but once you do, it's amazing what you can do.
So it's a lot of trial and error with trying the plants in the sand, and then a mixture of the kind of growing media and the climate as well. Do you kind of go in and water a lot during the warm bits, or do you try and leave it to itself to try and see how they cope with it?
Well, Peter Korn, I know that he waters very little, if at all. I think he said he waters only once or twice after planting. I think Peter is also a guy that plants things larger than I do. I have a well, my work schedule, I mean, up until the pandemic, I traveled a lot for work. So, you know, when I planted things, typically, I grow things from seed exchange, and that's the bulk of where I get my plants from. And I plant things in the season that I, you know, the season that I grow them. I don't store plants in a greenhouse for a year or two before planting them out. I plant them out as tiny seedlings. And I've never really been able to embrace the mindset that that Peter you know, has been so successful with in planting things. And only water them once. I plant tiny, tiny plants, and then, you know, in Vancouver, typically, the end of June, July happens, and you don't get a drop of rain. So, I do water heavily. Peter would probably scold me for it, but I haven't been able to wrap my mind around not watering. So, I do water quite a bit here in Vancouver. And you know, maybe when the plants that are out there have established a little bit more, or maybe next year, I'll see if I can wean them off that regular water. But the desert plants as well, I do, I water them quite a bit because I'm just looking for maximum growth in a summer that is reasonably, it's actually quite short here. It's not that short, but we don't get any real heat in Vancouver, so things don't agaves and whatnot, they don't grow like they would in their habitat, you know, with good monsoon conditions.
Yeah. So do you feed them quite heavily as well to just kind of keep them going a bit?
I haven't yet, and I can't see myself doing it unless things really slow down in the years ahead. But you know, with the advice that David Sellers gave me, he said that the fines in the seashelled sand provided quite a bit of nutrition, because the you know, the fines are right down to almost dust, The beauty of the sand is that it doesn't compact, like because of the irregular size of the granules and irregular sort of jagged shapes. It doesn't compact, but there are granules of all different sizes. And I've read, of course, before about stories from Scotland about farmers using dust from I'm not sure if it was from quarries or mines or whatever, but that stone dust played a huge part in crop success. And so far, it doesn't look like anything is lacking nutrition. So I haven't used any fertilizer at all. If I do, it's going to be a bit of a leap because I'm hard pressed to use chemical fertilizers. I would be more inclined to use something more earth friendly or organic than and very mild. If I fertilized, it would be a very, very, very mild fertilizer that I'd use.
And there was an old guy I was chatting with that was convinced that molehills were the best source of kind of aerated soil and nutrients and yeah, I know I'm possibly bringing up a bit of a sore spot for you because you put up a post not that long ago on social media of the moles going through parts of your garden as well.
Yeah, I think my friend the mole has left the yard now for I think the neighbors are suffering now, but I did have troubles. But it's funny you should mention that about the molehills, because my mom is a big fan of the soil that they kick up in a molehill. It's completely devoid of any rocks. It's just pure it's like pure virgin humus.
Yeah, he was absolutely convinced that it was great, and he'd try and grow seedlings in it, and they all, to my eye, looked as if they were perfectly happy seedlings. I couldn't vouch for it over any other method, but yeah, and then coming off of propagation as well, what's your kind of propagation schedule look like? Is there a particular time that you're sowing seeds? Because you've said that you were really busy. Is it something that you kind of do when the seeds are fresh, or if you're getting seeds from lots of different sources from the seed exchange, is it something that you're kind of doing for a large portion of the year to get all the plants you need?
Yeah, I try and get on it as quickly as I can after the seed exchanges have delivered here to the house. And the reason behind that is I want to maximize this stratification time for most of what I'm growing. And it's a good Vancouver's a good place to stratify because there's occasional frosts. There's plenty of rain. If I want to water, I just stick the trays outside and they get rained on, maybe get the odd dusting of snow on them. But I try and get it done as quickly as possible. It's usually just before Christmas or just after. And that's with seed. I do take a lot of cuttings when I can. I do sometimes root in the sand, in the seashelled sand, and I agree with the saxifrages. The sand is very effective. And I also do a lot of rooting in horticultural pumice, and that tends to be sort of late winter. I'll get a lot of species I can put woody or semi-wood. Hardwood cuttings into pumice and just put them outside on the deck with a heated mat underneath, and I've done well that way with things like Arctostaphylos, who try and get manzanita shrubs going and things like that.
Have you been trying that with like agaves and yuccas as well? You said they were an interest.
Yeah, if I can get pups off of or offsets from agaves and yuccas, then oftentimes, I mean, it's pretty hard to fail with offsets as long as you get enough root material. But you may have seen posts on Facebook where I showed offsets of agaves that I tried to remove and like just almost obliterated the little plant, like no root matter at all. And I've put it in pumice, and it's unbelievable how quickly and readily they'll produce new roots in just a small pot of pumice, kept in shade and protected from the sun. I've kind of resurrected a lot of plants that way, that I would have written them off.
Yeah, I'd done a bit of work with propagating some agaves and yuccas when I was working in Italy, and I found them incredibly difficult to split them nicely. I tend to damage them a bit, or maybe I'd get a portion of root, but it'd be a very small part of the root. So then we try and reroot them in a rooting media. If you get them off entirely, they're pretty much fine. They're just a young plant. But I did find them very tricky and pretty prickly to hold as well. They were a bit of a pain to get a good grip of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you should say that, because I have a large agave, a hardy one that I have in the garden, and it's the biggest one. And a friend gave that to me as a potted plant, and in its terracotta pot, it weighed like 40, 50 pounds, and it was almost impossible to get out of that pot and clean the roots and put it into pure sand. But it's a species that doesn't have that is not known for producing offsets. And lo and behold, in the pot at the very bottom, there was one offset that I managed to pry off. And it's a perfect example of a valuable plant. I was able to get a rare offset from it, but it was an offset I would have written off for sure. I didn't get any root material. It wasn't looking good, and was able to resurrect that in pumice. So I have a clone of the big plant should anything go wrong with the big plant. But yeah, trying to get it out of its pot, I definitely lost some blood. I definitely broke a few of the leaf tips, unfortunately, but it's recovering nicely for sure.
Yeah, they're like razors. There was quite a few of the agave americana that we had to lift for orders on the nursery, and yeah, they'd leave some marks on you for sure. They'd catch you if you weren't quite quick.
Yeah, somewhat of a labor of love, keeping plants like that. And I think some people might think we're a little bit nuts for having an interest in plants like that, and and particularly the cacti. But here we are.
Yeah, they're probably right, but yeah, it doesn't change it. So you've got your kind of garden in Vancouver, but you've got a kind of more, if you'd like to say, a kind of typical rock gardening property as well.
Yeah, I do. So I actually learned to garden more or less at my cabin, which is, I call it the cabin, but I have a small cabin on the property, but it's the family home. And the big house is just maybe 100 meters from the cabin. But in about 2000, my folks bought that property, and by 2003, I was gardening up there, and pretty much learned up there to do what I was doing. And because I'd never owned property before that, so I wasn't able to garden in Vancouver or anywhere else. So I 2003, I kind of cut my teeth up there, and it's a totally different climate. It's a totally different atmosphere gardening up there, different conditions, probably about half the precipitation, or maybe a third of the precipitation that we get here in Vancouver. Most of it falls as snow. It's more of a typical Canadian winter scene, or maybe the more stereotypical vision of Canada with the mountains and frozen lakes and snow and whatnot. Very short season. I expect frost there tomorrow. That will make it about a month that we've had a frost-free period this year, because I did record one in July as well. Different species. just owing to the fact that that property is on the east side of the Cascades, you get a different flora and lots of you can do a lot of interesting things up there. So yeah, it is different. I'm not so sure it's a more typical rock garden than what I've got in Vancouver anymore, because I up there I got into lots of steppe species, pretty much, a lot of native plants, a lot of things right from all elevations up there, from the valley bottoms to above tree line. And it's a magical place to test things out up there as well.
So you said that you got into gardening when you were up there. So have you always been interested in kind of nature, or did you kind of, as what's the term, an awakening up there? Did you kind of start doing it, or someone put you onto it and then you've kind of never looked back?
No, I mean, I've always been interested in gardening, and particularly in landscapes. My university degree is in geography. I've always had an interest in replicating landscapes, and not even just natural ones, but man-made ones as well. I have a garden in Vancouver that's kind of a tip of the hat to a cheesy Las Vegas boulevard setup with the palm trees and the whole bit. People say, "Wow, that looks like a tacky Las Vegas sidewalk garden." I'm like, "Thank you. I have achieved my vision." But
That was
no, I always had an interest in landscapes. I just didn't own property, and I grew up in an apartment in downtown Vancouver. I grew up in a condominium, and so I never really had the opportunity to do much outside as a teenager. And after university, I actually moved to the United Kingdom. I lived in Birmingham for about a year, I guess. Yeah, about a year. And we rented a flat, and it had a bit of a garden out front. So I did a little bit in the United Kingdom, and when I came back again, I was sentenced to apartment living. So when my folks bought that property up there, I was raring to go. But I'd been steeped in the Vancouver hardy tropical plant sort of culture that swept through, and is still strong in Vancouver. And of course, up there, when temperatures are south of minus 30, you're not going to have much success with palms or whatnot. So I started to broaden my horizons, and rock gardening started to emerge as the way to go. And then you start chatting with people online and getting new ideas, and went from there. But long story short, to answer your question, I do have an interest in nature for sure. And the local mountains have absolutely the local mountains and the local dry basins up there definitely inspired what I did in the gardens for sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of kind of young folk can attest to that as well. There's certainly the house prices, I think pretty much everywhere in the world are quite crazy, to say the least. And to try and get, a place where you can live and actually have a garden as well is very tricky, really. I know a lot of young folk that are kind of champing at the bit to be gardening, but can't garden at their home because they're in a flat, and then you walk in and they've got plants everywhere. I had about, I think, 70 to 100 different genera in the flat, and I kind of made that up over a year. And there was some alpines in there that really weren't happy and shouldn't be living in a flat. And there was cacti, and there was little trees, and yeah. So I think it's definitely refreshing to kind of get a run at it when you have the luxury to do so. But it is a luxury for a lot of us that, have been looking to get a property for a very long time.
Yeah, it is kind of a shame, that the time that we live in, people, I would guess that younger people preoccupied with other things as well. And we, you know, like you said, the house prices, the cost of real estate is really probably additionally driving them away from, you know, any relationship they have with the land. And yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
I was about to say we'll maybe stay clear of that and get back to the good stuff, but but yeah, as for hiking, you were saying, so you've gathered a lot of inspiration for some of the kind of local routes surrounding you, or was it when you were on your travels, have you managed to hike and see different places and that's kind of inspired you, or has it been a bit of both, or?
Maybe a little bit of both. I do like the drive up to my cabin from the house in Vancouver takes me through a provincial park, and I post a lot of pictures from there. I go through Manning Provincial Park, and it's a very special place. It's kind of that it's the geographical point where you get the juxtaposition of, you know, the Pacific sort of cooler, rainier weather, and then on the other side of the divide, you're more into that sort of dry, almost Great Basin type climate, and it's right at that juxtaposition that you get some really interesting and unique flora. So I've been, yes, I've been very inspired by you know, walks I've taken in Manning Park and seeing plants in natural habitat. I've been able to experience that with a lot of friends, including folks that, you know, folks you know. I've been up there with Mike Kinchin. I've been up there with Cliff and Sue Booker. We try and go if we have guests to the Alpine Garden Club of BC, you know, especially in that sort of June, July, August sweet spot. We try and take folks up there to have a look around and see what Canada looks like in its montane and subalpine and alpine sort of environments. Paul Spriggs and I took Marcela Ferreira up there, and that's probably the last time I did a really good full day. I've been pretty busy, but I do often stop the car and take pictures, even just at the roadside, on my way up and down from the cabin.
Yeah, I managed to. Paul came to visit the Botanics as well, and he done a couple talks and then helped design one of the crevice gardens in a garden called Inveryew, which the Scottish Rock assisted in as well. And Paul was the kind of archetypal Canadian person. He was absolutely lovely to chat to, incredibly nice. Incredibly knowledgeable as well, and yeah, completely mad about plants. There seems to be a very kind of strong connection from all the Canadians that I've met with the kind of natural world and all plants, not just alpine plants. And yeah, it was really great to kind of experience that with him and kind of walk the garden and get his perspective on certain things. I know Jenny, from Munich Botanical Garden was very excited to be going there. Unfortunately, I think that's all been postponed. But yeah, it's been an area that I've really wanted to kind of explore a bit more and really spend a bit more time up there.
Well, you got to get out here to see it, and when you do, I'd be happy to show you around, and I'm sure we can drag Paul out too. He's always good for a trip into the wilderness. He does some very impressive backcountry walks for sure.
Yeah, no, he's a of a mad person, but yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
So I was just wanting to throw a bit of a curveball in, just because I was really interested when you posted this, and a lot of other people were. You put up a photo of a veg that I think you'd either grown or you'd purchased, and you'd kind of chopped them off at the base and then stuck them in a kind of plastic container with water, and they kind of regrew their roots, and then you planted them back back out in the veg garden. Could you explain that in a bit more detail? Because I saw it and thought it was partly sorcery and then partly genius as well. I was a bit confused.
So I have to divulge, I'm not the sorcerer. That's actually the better half that is the brain trust of those types of things, and especially anything to do with vegetable gardening. But yeah, she with things like celery, lettuce, green onions, when you buy them from the store, oftentimes they come with some root material and or at least the bases intact that are that sufficient to regrow root material. So just as an example, when you buy green onions, if you just use the tops and leave even just an inch of the white sort of bulb end of the onion, if you leave that and just tip it so that it's bottom down in like a centimeter of water, it'll respr it'll resprout roots, and you can keep using the same onion over and over again. And it also gives you a head start in the spring if you're buying your groceries and you buy a lettuce that still has root material. I'm not sure if you can buy lettuce that way all over the world, or if it's a North American thing or even just Canada. I don't know, but you can buy lettuce that has roots, and chop the top of its head off and use the lettuce and plant the bottom. You don't even have to put that in water if it's already got root matter. But yeah, she does that with celery as well. Trying to remember what else she does it with, but celery in particular, it's really handy because it's slow to grow, and our vegetable garden is unfortunately tucked in behind a grove of huge Douglas firs. So it's pretty shady, and if we didn't plant celery that was already half grown, we probably wouldn't be able to get any celery from seed. So yeah, it's pretty sorcery, as you say. It's witchcraft for sure.
Yeah, another recent one that I saw was with rhododendrons, where they took a cutting of rhododendron and then grafted on top of an unrooted cutting, which I'd never actually seen before. I'm very curious to see if it would work with certain other plants like Daphnes. But yeah, I'm always perplexed and fascinated by the ingenuity of kind of gardeners from different parts of the world as well. It kind of brings it all home from you talking about Peter Korn and David's kind of intuition with the gardening and the seashell sand, to then the kind of your inspiration from nature and then bringing it home and kind of embracing kind of new things and trying it out. It's quite fascinating how it all, yeah, kind of meanders, but normally works out quite well.
Yeah, it's a great hobby. It never stops feeding you new things to be curious about, which is, I always say, is the key to not getting old, is to remain curious. And like I was saying, the pandemic, what really hurts now that we're months into it, is it's really missing the people that you meet and talk to. And got to find a way to get out of this or adapt to this sort of new reality that we're in, because yeah, I really do I do miss the social element of it as well. It's good to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure, an education to chat to you as well. I found it fascinating. And yeah, we'll need to do it in real life as well. You'll have to come over to Utrecht, to the Netherlands, and I can show you around.
I will do that. It's been years since I was in the Netherlands, and never long enough when I was there. So I would look forward to that for sure.
All right.
We can fly again.
Yeah. Well, aye. Hopefully soon, but we'll see. But no, thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Jay. Thank you.
Thanks, Connor. Talk to you later.